Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Last week, we began a two-part look at the lawsuit filed last year by Delawareans for Educational Opportunity and the NAACP Delaware State Conference of Branches. The suit is challenging Delaware's system of funding public education in the Court of Chancery, contending that inequities in the funding system impair the opportunity of disadvantaged students to receive an adequate education. The plaintiffs also argue the current system for levying property taxes at the county level contributes to the problem because it violates long-established standards set by the Delaware General Assembly. In Part 1 last week, contributor Larry Nagengast examined the thorny issue of assessments and property taxes. This week, he delves into another piece of the suit, the actual system used by the state to deliver education funding. The piece is online right now at DelawarePublic.org, and Larry sat down with me earlier this week to discuss it. So the argument the plaintiffs are making seems to boil down to this. Not enough money is reaching students that need it most. Low-income students, English language learners, students with disabilities. And your piece suggests that the state's own numbers show that these groups do need more support. How stark are those numbers?
Well, it's pretty bleak. In the first pages of the opinion that he issued in late November, Vice Chancellor Travis Laster itemizes the performance of low-income English language learners and special education students on the state's Smarter Balanced Assessment Test for the 2015-16 and 2016-17 school years. For the 2015-16 school year, the best performance of any of these subgroups was 35.6% of the low-income students gaining a proficient rating in language arts. That's just over one-third of the students in that grouping. English language learners and special ed students were less successful in language arts, and the proficiency levels in math were even lower for all three of these groups. And this pattern repeated itself in 2016-17. In some areas, proficiency levels fell to being as low as 10%. Now, what this shows, through the testing system that the state chose and through the scoring system that the state created, is that a very large proportion of the children are not developing the skills that they need to function as productive adults in our society. Low-income students represent 37% of the public school population, special ed students 15%, and English language learners 7%. Now, even when you allow for the overlap of students who fit into two of these groups, or perhaps all three, we're talking about close to one-half of the public school population.
And we've already seen that the judge in this case, as you mentioned, Vice Chancellor Laster, he seems to find these numbers pretty compelling based on what he wrote about them in that opinion you cited, rejecting the state's request that the suit be dismissed. What did he say, kind of putting these numbers in context, at least from his perspective?
Well, in filing the suit, the plaintiff's attorneys assembled a lot of data on how state funds were allocated, and they also summarized initiatives that have helped disadvantaged students in other states to do better academically. Laster looked at all of this information, and he described the state's funding system in one word: counterintuitive. Now, why did he say that? Well, because he found, and let me give you the quote, "The educational funding system generally provides more support for more privileged children than it provides for impoverished children. Schools with more disadvantaged students receive less financial support from the state than schools with fewer disadvantaged students."
So what was the state's argument to dismiss, given their own proficiency numbers that we've cited? And how did Laster respond to what the state was trying to say was the reason why this wasn't a problem?
You know, when we talked last week, I described how the county defendants on the property assessment side of this case couldn't refute the facts, so they relied on some technicalities to try to get off the hook, and the judge didn't buy it. On the funding side of the case, the state has tried a similar tactic. The state claimed that all the state constitution requires is that the school system be, quote, general and efficient, that it really doesn't matter whether the students who passed through that system were learning anything. Well, the judge didn't buy that claim either, and he created what he described as a nightmare scenario, something that could possibly occur if that was what the state really, really believed. So here's what he wrote. The state could corral disadvantaged students into warehouses, hand out one book for every 50 students, assign some adults to maintain discipline, and tell the students to take turns reading to themselves. Okay, you know, that's obviously an extreme example, an extreme scenario that the vice chancellor put into his own words. But you know, if you carry the state's position, you know, to an extreme extension, that's conceivably what you could have. I mean, they're not saying that the school system really has to do anything, measurable to educate students.
So, with that in mind, what do the plaintiffs want to see happen to make sure that the money gets where it needs to go and help the students that need that help the most?
Okay. Well, you know, generally there are two pieces to the solution. First, the plaintiffs say that there's a need for more and better services. This means, among other things, hiring more teachers to create smaller class sizes, adding reading specialists and math coaches, starting after-school programs, expanding counseling services, and doing more to address the trauma and stress these students face outside the classroom. The second piece is how you're going to pay for it. And this is where political will has been lacking for years. It's going to require more money, and the middle and upper middle class adults whose children go to the schools that are now getting more money are not going to be happy if they see their school budgets cut. And I suspect that some of them will resent paying more taxes if additional money is going to be spent on schools that their own children don't attend. Now, the state is saying that they don't want the courts to come up with the solution. They want the legislature to do it. This issue has been talked about for years, but the legislature hasn't done anything yet. Will it be different this time? Well, we're just going to have to see.
And we are seeing some efforts from the state and the Carney administration to address these funding inequities, specifically what seems to be the first real stab at something approaching weighted funding, and that is Governor Carney's three-year $60 million plan that we've reported on previously to target English language learners and low-income students. For those unfamiliar, can you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of what that plan is and what it's trying to accomplish?
Okay, well, it's $20 million a year for 3 years, and it would go to all of the schools in the state, and the money would be allocated with $300 extra going to each low-income students, $500 extra for each English language learner. Now, schools would have pretty broad discretion in creating plans for spending the money. There's no one-size-fits-all plan here, Colonial School District Superintendent Dusty Blakey tells me. You know, as one example, you know, districts that have low-income or English language learner students concentrated in one or two schools might start by doing intensive programs in those schools. If these disadvantaged students with special needs are spread more evenly throughout the district, you know, perhaps they take a different approach, maybe do something like with teacher training, so that all of the teachers in the district would be exposed to, you know, better theories, better approaches to working with all these students. So, you know, the situation, how the money might be allocated, how the programs might be developed, is going to depend upon the situation within the district. Regardless of what type of program gets created, ultimately they're all going to be evaluated in 3 years by the State Department of Education. The ones that would seem to be working the best are likely, again, depending on the availability of funds down the road, but the ones that seem to be working best would be candidates to be replicated in other school districts.
So what's the reaction been to this plan? Is it seen as enough?
Yeah, generally the reaction has been positive. The legislators that I've talked to think that the plan will make it all the way through the state budget process. And, you know, there are a couple of issues here, and I think it's fair to say, you know, people are looking at this thing, this is a first step. It's not the final answer. First, there's this concern with the Department of Education and how they're going to evaluate these pilot programs. You know, DOE can't use a system that relies heavily on standardized test scores. I mean, because we know what the standardized test scores have shown is that if you've got a lot of low-income and English language learner students in your schools, your school is going to perform poorly. And if you have smaller percentages of these, your scores are going to be better. So the test scores themselves are not a really good indicator here. The measurement has to, and you've got to consider that's because these so many students are starting below grade level. So the measurement can't be whether students are working at grade level, but rather it has to be the growth that they're showing. And they can measure this. So the idea is, how well are these students doing at being able to catch up to their peers? Are they closing the gap individually? Now, the second concern is that the governor's proposal covers only 3 years. Both educators and lawmakers know that they need a plan that will be sustainable and that it'll be permanent. And this gets us back to the funding issue that I was talking about a minute ago. Once again, we're going to have to see what happens.
Well, with that in mind, and the idea that this is a first step as opposed to maybe a final solution, which you mentioned, are there other plans out there that could work kind of concurrently with this or address other pieces of this as an issue?
Nobody is ready to talk about anything comprehensive and long-term. Well, I mean, they're talking about it, but there's nothing on paper that, that looks like a model or, a long-range blueprint. But there are things that are addressing pieces of the puzzle. A couple of legislators are talking about the real estate property assessment issue. They realize that they may have to act to require the counties to conduct new property assessments, but nobody has any details on that yet. Now, Representative Earl Jakes, who's chairman of the House Education Committee, he tells me that he is working on legislation that would give school boards limited authority to raise property taxes from year to year. This would largely replace our current referendum system, which we discussed last week, which costs a lot of time and money and often builds resentment among taxpayers who often see referendums as, the one chance that they have to say no to government at any level. Now, as Representative Jake sees it, when districts hold a referendum, what they do is they ask for a large pot of money to cover spending increases that they expect to incur over 4, 5, 6 years. And so then they start collecting this money, and a lot of it at the start anyway gets put in the school district's bank account. And so it's in the school district's pocket, rather than the taxpayer's pocket. And then the school districts gradually spend that money down. Now, Jakes thinks that property owners would rather see smaller tax increases, even if they came every year. And that way they would be able to hang on to their own money for a longer period of time. Now, also in the works, Representative Kim Williams is back with legislation that she's been pushing for the last 3 or 4 years, and that would provide more funds for special education students in kindergarten through third grade. And that's another group that whose issues are mentioned fairly significantly in the lawsuit.
Is it fair to say that this all may boil down to whether or not Vice Chancellor Laster finds these efforts you're talking about compelling and believes the state and lawmakers will actually follow through with them in the absence of a court order compelling them to do so? Is this a case where the plaintiffs are arguing, we've heard this all before, but where has it actually gotten us?
Yeah, you're right on both counts. From reading Laster's two rulings in this suit, it's pretty clear that the state is not going to get off the hook easily, or the counties for that matter. Face it, the state is kind of stuck. It's their own assessment system that's showing that the schools aren't serving disadvantaged children well. And the finance reforms that the plaintiffs are looking for are the same things that have been debated by educators and lawmakers in Delaware off and on for about 10 years, maybe longer. So by the time it's over, I believe the judge is going to tell the state that it has to do more. I'm not sure how much more, and that whatever it takes, whatever it's going to do, is going to have to be sustainable and permanent. It's not going to allow for any short-term fixes. As for the plaintiffs, I'm certain they will be asking that the judge retain some sort of jurisdiction over the case so that they will have the opportunity to go back in the court if they feel that the state isn't meeting whatever obligations are set out in the final ruling.
And finally, even though this case is not likely to be decided until next year, one thing that does appear clear is that it has created a greater sense of urgency. Is that a fair read of the situation?
Yes, most definitely. I would agree. I was reporting back in the 70s during the desegregation case, and back then, you know, if you asked a suburban or a downstate legislator what they would do, they'd say they'd fight that case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And if you asked them about a desegregation plan, well, you know, the best they could come up with would be some sort of a voluntary one. Now, today, when you talk to legislators, you'll get a much more measured response. They know that properties haven't been reassessed in some 40 years. They know that educators have been asking for more money for these programs for years, and they haven't delivered. They know that state education officials have been asking for and receiving federal grants to address these very same needs. Now, finding long-term solutions will not be easy. And I suspect that there are some legislators who are hoping they'll be able to tell their constituents that it's some judge's fault that the taxes are going up. You know, but the bottom line here is this. The legislators know that this case may well be wrapped up next year and that some change in the school funding system is almost inevitable. So this time around, Tom, I'm going to end it with a couple of questions. Who's going to make the changes? Will it be the General Assembly? Will Governor Carney lead the way? Or will it take another court order?
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time on The Green this week. This piece on the state's education funding system and last week's piece on assessments and property taxes are available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in just a moment with a look at research being done at Delaware State University that could identify athletes and others at high risk for ankle injuries. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media.